You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 22nd to the 28th of May 2014. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters Jack Grove and Holly Else and writer Matthew Rice. Is it the end for final salary pensions? That's the headline of this week's lead news article. More on the specifics of that in just a moment. The revelation that his father had been involved in counterinsurgency in 1940s India spurred Goldsmiths Professor Bart Moore Gilbert to undertake a quest that raised acute personal tensions. Matthew will tell us a little more about that quest soon. It's the subject of his feature this week. Could a plan to simplify the approval system for research undertaken within the NHS work? Not all are convinced that it will, reports Holly this week. And finally, could employers bypass universities by setting up their own massive open online courses? David Willetts, the HE Minister, thinks that they could, and we'll hear a little bit from a speech that he made last week. But first, Jack, pensions. And yeah, not that I look at you and immediately think of retirement, you understand, but your report this week is on the end, perhaps, of the final salary pension.
Yeah, this is really quite big news, actually, because there's basically a big deficit in the USS, the University Superannuation Scheme. That's the largest scheme in higher education, and about 150,000 university staff pay into it every month. And at the moment, there's a two-tier system. Those who joined it in 2011 are on a career average, but everyone else is on a final salary scheme. So your pension is linked to your final wage when you retire. Now, basically, USS have been circulating plans that say this is unaffordable. To preserve this, you'd have to put up employer contributions to about 25%, which would just be too much, employers say. So they're basically looking at plans to scrap the final salary scheme and replace it with a career average scheme.
They've got a big deficit to fill, basically, haven't they? £13 billion, I think, basically, your article state.
Yeah, basically, that's what the indicative figures suggest. The official figures will be published in September, but that's a big deficit. I mean, the USS is perhaps the biggest private pension scheme in the country. It's roughly the same size as the BT pension scheme.
Right.
And so this is quite a big story, lots of money involved and quite radical changes. And I mean, last time back in 2011, when they made some changes that prompted a lot of strikes and walkouts, and this is a far more radical plan. So you could easily see walkouts come
as a result.
Very possibly.
Is that the general response that you tended to get when you spoke to people about it? I mean, I guess some people who work in the private sector might be listening to this and say, well, you know, a career average scheme might still be quite generous compared to what other sectors receive. Did you get any feedback from people suggesting that it did need to change, this deficit did need to be tackled?
Well, there's different views out there, but there is a consensus that something needs to be done. I mean, even UCU, which opposed the changes last time, put up a good fight to save final salary pensions. Even they seem to be sort of suggesting that there might need to be a big change. And of course, all the financial analysts say there needs to be something major needs to happen.
Did anyone use the S word? Did anyone say strike could come?
Well, actually, these plans are so top secret that I've come across that no one really knows about it, so this is a genuine exclusive. So it'll be interesting in a couple of weeks, come back and ask me then whether people are saying strike or not, because this is the first really that people have heard of it.
Very good. Page 6 this week for the full lowdown on that. Now, Bart Moore Gilbert is Professor of Postcolonial Studies and English at Goldsmiths University of London. His new book, The Setting Sun, A Memoir of Empire and Family Secrets, looks into the life of his father. Matthew, you met up with him to find out what he discovered.
Okay, well, he grew up in what is now Tanzania, and his father, who was a rather charismatic figure, was killed in an accident when he was 12, and he has very fond and idealised memories of this rather glamorous father. And he knew that his father had worked in the India police in the period leading up to Indian independence in 1947, but he didn't know much more than that. And suddenly, about 7 years ago, he got a letter from an Indian researcher basically saying that his father had been involved in counterinsurgency, and did he know any more? Mm. And he looked at various sources, and some of them said that his father had been involved in some rather brutal suppression of protests and so on. And so the book is about him trying to find out what the truth about his father was. And he spoke to some of his former colleagues in the Indian police. He even spoke to some of the people who'd kind of been protesting against the British rule. And everybody said different things. Some said his father was terrible. Some said his father was a very decent man, or at least as decent as you could be in the circumstances. Some, reported rather horrifying incidents. Some reported incidents where they were kind of running away from the British and hiding in Wells or dressing up in saris, almost like comic scenes. So a lot of aging people describing very different attitudes to his father based on different, everyone's an interested party based on their political views and so on. And at the same time, he was comparing all these things he was learning with his own memories, rather rose-tinted memories of his father. So it's a book both of historical research and of family research, trying to kind of get beyond the sort of childish, his boy's eye view of his father. So it's a very moving and intriguing book. And in a sense, he never quite finds out what the truth about his father was, which is not surprising. Historical events are so far back. But he kind of begins to acquire a lot of extra dimensions.
Yeah, I mean, some of those stories you say are pretty damning. I know you in your piece there's an excerpt from a book that describes an incident where the police lost self-control, perpetuated atrocities on the people, and Moore Gilbert is named as someone who got wide notoriety for his ruthlessness. So it must be quite difficult for him to when putting that book together to sort of come across those stories.
Yes, it is. I mean, it was very painful, but there are other sources who said very different things about his father, had very fond memories of his father. And of course, Indian people who worked in the India police alongside the British after independence, they often wanted to distance themselves from being seen as it were collaborators. And then there are people who have an interest in exaggerating how bad the British were and so on. So it's a very complicated process to try and disentangle the truth. It's probably impossible. And that's what makes the book so intriguing and interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting when members of your family have come down sort of on the wrong side of history, because so often we think of our parents and grandparents being involved in the great conflicts like World War II, when, they were definitely sort of
Definitely seen them in the right. Yeah, exactly.
And now, but there are people out there who have to sort of grapple with these more tricky issues regarding their family.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, Bartmore Gilbert's always been a critic of British imperialism, essentially, but he had these very fond memories of his father, and he never kind of brought them together. And the book is about a personal clash as well as the history.
Very interesting. For all of that, page 40 in this week's magazine, and of course on timeshighereducation.co.uk. Bringing it back to the present day, back to our news section, Holly, we'll come to you next, and a move to simplify the approval system for research undertaken in the NHS.
Yes, so the Department of Health has awarded around £5 million to the Health Research Authority, who kind of oversee the research that goes on within the NHS. And their plan really is to try and streamline the assessment process that an academic who wants to do some research in the NHS sort of has to go through in order to get their studies approved. People that we spoke to about these plans sort of had a bit of a mixed response really as to whether this can actually happen, because it's quite a complicated process. I mean, there's some national level systems in place, and then there are others at the local level which are to do with which hospitals or NHS trusts will actually be involved in the research, considering some studies like clinical trials may include hundreds of patients, so they usually span quite a few hospitals. And at the moment, a bit of a hold up in the assessment process is this local level NHS hospital approval. And that's what the HRA are trying to sort of overcome, that with the idea that if it's a bit more efficient, things can happen quicker and researchers can get out there and do their research.
But they don't seem to know how to do it effectively. Is that
well? I think they've got a plan. They want to move the legal assessment to the national level, whereas at the moment it's done by each individual trust. But I mean, some academics say that's where the problems may lie, because the trusts actually ultimately have the legal responsibility for the work that goes on in the hospital. So they might not be able to surrender that to a national body as easily as the HRA may think.
I was quite struck when I went to the University of Birmingham just how close the university and the hospital works alongside each other, and there's actually a walkway connecting to the laboratory over the road to the hospital, and so they can just sort of whiz patients back and forth between the different places, and that hospital is actually where Malala Yousaf was taken, and they were saying that, you know, if it wasn't for all this amazing cutting-edge academic research, they wouldn't have been able to do, you know, quite a lot of the stuff that helped save her life. So
that's really interesting. I mean, I don't know what the whether it's every trust that has these issues or whether it's just some. Most people said that the HRA have done a lot actually to streamline the process so far. The last 10 years, things have improved quite dramatically. But there are still occasions when academics are waiting, say, a year to get their studies approved. And they argue that's really valuable time for research that's getting eaten up and stopping these potentially life-saving treatments getting to patients.
There are interesting stuff on page 10. I should say we record this podcast just outside the newsroom, so apologies if there's a bit of background noise creeping in this week. But alongside that article from Holly is a piece I wrote after speaking to HE Minister David Willetts shortly after he himself spoke at the MOOCs and Humanities Conference at Edgehill University last week. Here's an excerpt on what he had to say.
First of all, on the problem of credentials, what are the recognisable credentials you get at the end of a MOOC? I do think that employers are already shaping and involved in courses which, once a significant number of employers say, we will take evidence that you've done this course as the basis at least for giving you an interview, some of the formal accrediting processes within education can be bypassed. And when we've been having conversation with employers in the IT industry, some of whom are quite frustrated, because when you look at the employment outcomes, it's extraordinary. Computer science, despite the fact they're crying out for computer scientists, computer science is a university course that scores quite badly, quite high rates of unemployment of people who graduate with computer science, because it doesn't look as if computer science as taught in university quite aligns with the needs of employers. So they are looking at bypassing this, and of course this is where MOOCs began in the US, and constructing artificial intelligence, computer science courses online. And if you can prove that you have completed that course, they would accept that as a basis for considering you for employment.
More on that story on page 11 this week. We'll leave it there for now for this week's podcast, though. If you've got anything to say about the articles we've discussed in today's episode, you can do so at timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll find us on Twitter. You'll find us on Facebook. You'll also find us on LinkedIn and Google+. Do please get in touch. But that's all for this week's Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.